It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 387 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. It's another great Kickstarter doubleheader weekend, and it kicks off with Carl Kiesel and his wonderful book, Impossible Jones. It's a great superhero book in which the female lead is believed to be a superhero even though she starts out as a thief, so she runs with it. We talk about how the character came to be as well as what the book will look like, so I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. You can go directly to the Kickstarter via ImpossibleKickstarter.com. Then everything wraps up with Brent Larson from Kalis. The first issue is available for support on Kickstarter, and they've already met their goal, but they have great stretch goals in mind, so I think you're really going to enjoy this high-octane science fiction story. We discuss how this book came to be, as well as what the future might hold. So I think you'll enjoy what Brent has to say as well. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show.
Yeah, you know, I'm using my powers for good. Not evil. Mostly.
It's great to welcome to the podcast Carl Kiesel, one of my very favorite comics creators who makes all kinds of wonderful stuff. I could spend the whole next hour talking about the stuff that Carl has done that I really enjoyed, but let's not do that. Let's get right to the Kickstarter that you've got going right on. Carl, how are you?
I'm doing great, Wayne. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's good to talk with you. I actually got to meet you before we did this. I saw you at HeroesCon.
Yep.
And that's usually the other way around. I usually talk to somebody, and then I go to a con, and then I meet them.
Yeah.
So I got to do things a little differently with you. But your Kickstarter is called Impossible Jones, Grin and Gritty, a Graphic Novel. So, Carl, why don't you talk about what Impossible Jones is all about?
Yeah, Impossible Jones is a thief, and she gets some powers and then is mistaken for a superhero. And, a light bulb goes on over her head, and she says, yeah, that's right, I'm a superhero. And hilarity and hijinks follow.
Okay. So who is she as a character? I mean, you say that she's a thief and stuff, but how old is she? You know, where does this take place? Those kinds of good basic things.
Well, I mean, I imagine she's a young... You know, I'm guessing 20-something. If she's 30, I'd be surprised. You know, she's, she's, spunky, and a lot of time she works by the seat of her pants, makes it up as she goes along. I guess appropriately to her powers, she is a very flexible and adaptable person, mm-hmm. because she does have, I guess, what you would call stretching abilities. I prefer to think of it as she has complete control over the size and shape of her body and the outfit she's wearing, which, just happened to be what she was wearing when the horrible thing that happened to her happened to her. Mm-hmm. So, it's interesting. I was talking to someone, I will admit right now, Wayne, that one of the reasons I wanted to do this book is I wrote the first Harley Quinn monthly series, and I really loved writing that book. Mm-hmm. I can make no claim on creating that character. That was Paul Dini. Mm-hmm. But the character is really vibrant, really alive. And Impossible Jones... partly exists because I wanted to write that sort of character again. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, I do think that there are some big differences. I think, if you ask me, Harley Quinn exists in her own little bubble, and the world has to deal with her on her terms. Mm-hmm. Impossible Jones, on the other hand, is very aware of the world around her and is very adaptable to situations. So you could drop either of them into almost any situation, and they instantly fit in. Harley, because she kind of never realizes she's in a different situation. She just continues to be herself. And Impossible Jones fits in because she sees what's going around and she adapts to it. So I think Impossible Jones is much more aware than Harley. I would argue that she's smarter than Harley.
Hmm. Interesting. Now, I have to mention, there's a wonderful thing here that's there's a banner that says, using her powers for good, not evil, mostly.
Mostly. Yeah. Mostly. You know, she's only posing as a hero. And, you know, another one of the taglines we kind of banter around for Impossible Jones is, you think crime doesn't pay? Try being a superhero. Because no one gives them money. There's no check. There's no stipend. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, coming into this, the only way she knows how to make a living is through thievery. Mm-hmm. And so she's balancing the two. Let me put it that way.
Mm-hmm. So it's going to be interesting. Of course, will we see her life before? You said there's some event that happens that causes her to have these abilities.
Yeah. We do start, is the word, in medias res, in the middle of the story, but there is flashbacks to her life before. You know, her old gang is very important in the first story arc, and specifically she does have a boyfriend who will be around for some time for the future.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. Another thing you say here is really funny. It says, I first thought of Impossible Jones as a monthly comic, but the first issue became 27 epic pages, and now it's 132 pages. Graphic novel, collecting what would have been the first five issues of her comic, The Irrepressible Imp's Entire Origin Story.
That's what we're doing.
So is this, it looks like it is, the one picture on there looks like it's hardcover?
Yes, it is going to be a hardcover. For anyone that has seen or backed the Section Zero book, we're doing the exact same thing. I call them the Ultra Cool Collector's Editions. They are hardcover. They are oversized. They're, you know, slightly larger than a comic book, about 10-15% larger. Mm-hmm. The size of some of DC's deluxe hardcovers or the Saga hardcovers are also slightly larger. That's the size we're going with. If we can hit the stretch goals, there would be spot gloss. There would be full color end sheets. There would be a real swanky ribbon bookmark. Mm-hmm. I mean, I want this to be a very, you know, like the ultimate Impossible Jones book.
Well, as you know, I bought the Section Zero book from you at up at Heroes Con, which I really loved. Of course, I love that comic, too. I mean, you just keep making great stuff as far as I'm concerned, so I'm always there. I can't wait to see all these good things. So I have to ask you about I always like to ask this because I am interested in strong female lead characters. Mm-hmm. And I often tell the story in this podcast. I have some female friends of mine who think that a woman lead character should be very maternal. By that, they talk their problems out. They're very motherly, you know, those kinds of things. And I get a sense that Impossible Jones is not necessarily along those lines.
You know, I would say, you know, that's an interesting question, I have to say. And I have to say, it depends on the situation. I think if she sees that that's the best way out of a situation, that's what she's going to do. Hmm. If she sees that that is a dead end, she is not going to go down that road. And, you know, she thinks on her feet. She thinks quickly. She doesn't always necessarily make the right choice. I'll say that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of this story is about her making dubious, to say the least, choices. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I could see her doing that. I could see her talking her way out. I can definitely see her talking her way out of a situation, talking through physical confrontation. I'm not sure. You know that I'm not sure. We would have to see what happens when it happens.
See, but that's interesting to me. I mean, I don't want somebody who's always going to be maternal. I want somebody who can be whatever she needs to be at the time, like that. Because that's interesting to me. It's kind of like, you know, I hate to say it, but Superman's in trouble these days because he's so ultimately moral. You know, he's always going to make the quote unquote right decision. That kind of stuff. And so going into that, you know, Batman's more interesting because he doesn't necessarily have that level of morality to go with. And it sounds like Impossible Jones is also somebody like that who doesn't necessarily, well, she's not Superman as far as her morals go.
Definitely not. No, definitely not. And, you know, she is trying to survive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do think, you know, not that I read every comic that's out there, so there's probably other comics that have tread this ground, but I want to say, again, people don't pay superheroes to be superheroes, and, you know, and maybe this is, quite honestly, I never thought of it until just now, maybe this is reflecting my struggle with creator-owned comics, because, you know, we're trying to raise this money, because we have to eat too, you know. I cannot produce this comic for free, just like Impossible Jones can't go around being a good guy for free. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so maybe there's a little more personal connection than I realized here.
Well, it's really interesting to me because I like the fact that she is this person that we may not be able to figure out ahead of time exactly what she's going to do. And that's more fun. I think that's
Definitely.
I love to see when somebody I just don't know exactly what they're going to do. And, of course, the fun is it's consistent within her character to be surprising us. And that's the kind of thing that's kind of fun to read.
Yeah. Generally speaking, I like it without hitting someone over the head. I do like it when a character's powers kind of reflect their personality. I think that makes a real cohesive character. And, you know, as I said, she's a very adaptable person and a very flexible person. And, you know, the fact that she can change her shape to fit the moment, it reflects her personality too.
Now, I have to ask, where did she come from? I mean, you talked about Harley a little bit. When you were working on Harley, did she give birth to Impossible Jones, or was it after Harley you kind of missed and you wanted to do more? How did Impossible Jones come to be?
Well, I've told other people this story, so I don't see any reason to keep it a secret. Okay. I literally woke up one morning and knew how I wanted to do Plastic Man. I knew how he would be exciting and interesting to me. And if you know Plastic Man's origin, he's a thief. He's on a job. Something horrible happens to him. He wakes up. He has superpowers. And he says, I will fight crime. And I woke up one morning and I said, no. What he should have said was, I have superpowers. I'm going to get payback on the sons of bitches who left me behind to die. And he goes, you know, and so this is what I'm doing is I'm taking it, making a woman. She goes after her old gang. But, you know, from the outside looking in, she's going after criminals. And that's when someone says, you must be a superhero. And that's when the light bulb goes on over her head, realizing I'm a wanted criminal otherwise. And, you know, like I said, the idea came to me for Plastic Man. I folded it in with Harley Quinn. And we ended up with Impossible Jones.
See, that's fun to me. That's different. I mean, I have no idea what she's going to do when. I like that. I'm just anxious to see what kinds of good things you're going to tell, what kind of stories you're going to do, and where she's going to go. Because, you know, based on what you're telling me, I don't have a clue. And I like that. I don't want to know. I don't want to be able to figure out ahead of time what's going to happen. I want to be able to be surprised. And it sounds like you're going to do a great job of that.
Well, that's what we're aiming for. You know, David and I are both very excited and very committed to this project, and we got a lot of ideas to carry us into the future. If we can, you know, if we can make this one work, then we can make the next one work. And if we can make the next one work, maybe we can keep doing this, you know, one graphic novel a year. That would be really ideal. And, you know, we tell as many stories as we have, and then we can move on. But right now we have a lot of stories we could tell.
Cool. Very cool, because, again, I like female lead characters, and I don't think we have nearly enough of them, to be honest. So when I saw this, I immediately said, oh, boy, that's going to be something I'm going to really want to support. And right away I got on and supported the Kickstarter. And we should mention right away, what's the web address that we go to go directly to your Kickstarter?
It's very simple. I try to make it as simple as possible because I'm a pretty simple guy, and that is just go impossiblekickstarter.com. That takes you right there. ImpossibleKickstarter.com.
Now, of course, if you do this again in the future, you could always use that again for Impossible Jones 2 or something like that.
Yes, I could.
Now, of course, we're recording this a little ahead of time. You're roughly about halfway through when we're recording this. This will post a little after that. But you've got almost, at the time we're recording, you've got about 600 backers.
Yeah, we're doing good backer-wise. It is very different from Section Zero. Section Zero had some high-end rewards that got snapped up. And the Impossible Jones people, maybe because she is an unknown quantity, we're getting a lot of people pledging for the digital package or just the book. And the high-end stuff is just sitting around. It very well may be, in order to get funded, that we will actually end up needing more backers than I had on Section Zero, which, you know, it's very, I don't know, interesting is, I guess, the word I would use, because I'm still figuring out this Kickstarter thing. And so when something doesn't go the way I thought it was going to go, I'm going, huh.
Well, it's interesting to me because I always refer to this as the daily heart attack. You know, you log in, nobody has backed since the last time you logged in, and you have a little bit of a heart attack going, oh, no, people don't support it, that kind of stuff. And so I don't think that's going to happen with your case, because I think you've got a lot of tremendous stories. I mean, Sex and Zero is just one of those great books that I love. I just think it's You know, it's kind of a Fantastic Four with a little bit of a twist to it mm-hmm. that I like. You know, that impossible word, I always like that. An adventure has a lot to do with the stories you tell. And those are the things that just winners for me. I've got to be involved with that.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, I have to say I am a huge fan of adventure comics. Although saying that, I would say, you know, Impossible Jones is a superhero comic, and it is almost by design set up to be able to tell all the different superhero ideas that I would ever want to tell. I mean, she operates out of a fictitious town called New Hope City, which is sometimes referred to as No Hope City. Mm-hmm. And we purposely only have, like, I think, four other superheroes in town. And quite honestly, only two of those four are, I guess, what you would say, full-time superheroes or around a lot. The other two kind of come and go. Mm-hmm. So there's not a lot of superheroes in this town, but there's always a lot of villains showing up. So that way we have some interesting interplay with the characters. But it's not like a bad thing happens and the Avengers rush in. You know, they don't exist in this town. And the other superheroes that are running around, two of them are characters I created in second grade. And dusted off for this when I was looking around to fill out the cast. And one is Captain Lightning. I invented him in second grade, and he has lightning powers. And the only thing that is different is somewhere, you know, a long time ago, I became very interested in the idea of a superhero who might have political aspirations. Ooh. And Captain Lightning would really like to be mayor of New Hope City. And so that colors an awful lot of his interaction with people. And because, you know, he certainly doesn't want to do anything that'll come back to haunt him when he finally decides to run. Mm. So on one hand, he seems to be, you know, the Captain America sort. He's the upstanding hero of the city. But on the other hand, everything he does is very politically motivated and tinged. So I find that very interesting.
So he kisses babies and stuff like that?
Well, maybe not to that level, but, you know, he's very careful about what he says to people. He does not want anything he says to come back, you know, to be thrown in his face later on, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other character I created in second grade is a character called Polecat. And when I was a kid, I did not know Polecat was slang for skunk. Oh. I just thought, he's a cat character with a pole. And to me, you know, that was, why has no one used this really great name? Because, Carl, it means skunk. That's why. It also means a type of ferret, I guess. But at least where I grew up in upstate New York, it was known to be slang for skunk. Mm-hmm. But I always really liked Polecat. And so I sat there and I said, what if Polecat's a city boy and he doesn't know what it means skunk either? And he names himself that, and too late he discovers the truth, and now he's stuck with his name. And but Polecat is he's I would say the real moral compass of the series. He really is an altruistic guy, and he's really trying to do the right thing for all the right reasons. And he's actually very likable. In fact, Impossible Jones finds herself liking him in spite of herself. And because of that, she ends up doing more good than she probably normally would, just because, oh, he asked me to help. How can I say no? You know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You know,
I've got to ask about the goggles that she wears, because I find that interesting. A lot of, you know, usually superheroes are covered with masks or stuff like that, but she wears goggles. I mean, why did you make that kind of a choice?
Well, that actually has to do with her origin. She was wearing a special suit for a special reason, and that suit included goggles as protective eyewear. Mm. And when she was, you know, when she gained her powers or was transformed or whatever you want to say, everything she was wearing was transformed along with her. So she's got these goggles, and she can change their shape. She can make them into binoculars. Mm. You know, she can make them into sunglasses. David had said at one point, and he, I don't know if he really emphasizes it in his drawings, but he goes, I'm never going to draw a strap on these goggles. They're just like glued onto her forehead.
Yeah. So, you're right. As I look at it, I don't see a strap there. I just sort of assumed they were there.
Yeah.
But you're right. They're not there. This is a part of her.
Yeah, so she can, you know, change the shape of the goggles and change the shape of her uniform, you know, into an evening gown, into, you know, just a nice little relaxing jumpsuit, if that's, you know, whatever she needs to transform her outfit into. It stays the same colors. She can't get away from the yellow and black and white. But, I mean, really, our if we hit our second stretch goal, our second stretch goal is paper dolls, because not only can she change her outfit to look, you know, like a million different outfits, she can change her hairstyle to look like a million different hairstyles, but she can grow extra arms. And I thought the greatest way to show that would be using the classic idea of paper dolls. So that's our second stretch goal, if we can hit that.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, let's hope so, because all these things are lots of fun. And you bring up a subject I wanted to ask you about, and that is, we talked a little bit about how the adventure plays in, but one of the things you do really well, and I think that Impossible Jones is going to be a great vehicle for this, is to make comedy or humor something that's, you know, so many people kind of go like, oh, we can't have funny books, they can't be funny, you know, but you seem to be able to do humor in such a way that it integrates perfectly well with the story. So I'm just kind of, because what I've seen of it, and of course Section Zero has a lot of that, there little things that will happen that makes things fun and interesting while the adventure is still going on.
Yeah,
I expect we'll probably see some of that in Impossible Jones as well.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I don't think comics is comics without humor. I mean, I like humor in just about everything. I can't think of anything. I think the last thing I did watch a Netflix series called Black Summer, which was a zombie miniseries. And I have to say, I noticed. I said, my God, there is not one joke in this whole thing, not one moment of levity. Anyways, but I generally prefer. I actually agree with Joss Whedon is if, you know, you have a funny moment and then, you know, more or less slam cut to a dramatic moment or a scary moment, the juxtaposition increases the effect of both, you know? And I think these should be fun. I think comics should be fun. Mm-hmm. I don't think they should be a chore to read. I don't think it should be, I certainly understand the idea of putting characters through paces and doing horrible things to them, but there's got to be a sense of hope. There's got to be a sense that there is a light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm. See, there's that word again, adventure.
Yeah.
That's what I like. I like something that is, you know, is lighthearted to some degree, but yet there's still danger involved.
Right, exactly.
Those are things that I like about your stuff, too. So I did want to ask, too, about David Hahn, the artist on this, who I guess he's known for Batman 66. How did you and David team up on this? I mean, did you guys talk together and kind of figure you wanted to work on something, and this is what you guys developed?
Well, I've known David, I can't believe this, but, you know, close to 15, 18 years now, you know, back in 2001, 2002, somewhere around there. There was he lived in Portland at the time, as I do. And Wednesday afternoons, there was a little like a coffee clatch of cartoonists that got together at a local coffee shop. And they got together Wednesday afternoons because that's when the Marvel and DC editors were having their editorial meeting. So we knew none of them were going to be calling us, and we couldn't call any of them. And David was young, breaking into the field at that point. He had been doing a creator-owned book called Private Beach. And right away, I just took to his art, to his style, and to him, too. He's a very, very easygoing guy, and I got along very easily with him from the very beginning. And quite honestly, over the next, you know, like I said, 15 years or something, every so often an opportunity would come up for us to work together, and I always jumped at those opportunities. We actually did two or three backup stories for Marvel together at one point. And the first time I tried to do a creator-owned comic, a webcomic, it was called Johnny Zombie, and it is it's actually on my website, panicbuttonpress.com. You can read it right now. It was a Christmas story, a Johnny Zombie Christmas story, and I called up David and I asked him to pencil it. So, and then, you know, more recently, he penciled and I inked two Batman 66 miniseries, Batman 66 meets the Man from U.N.C.L.E. and then Batman 66, Wonder Woman 77.
Yeah.
You know, I just can't say no to working with David. And, you know, somewhere in there, you know, I just said to him, you know, I got this idea and I think you'd be good for it. And he made my day. He said he'd love to do it.
Wow. Well, that's cool. It doesn't sound like it took a lot of convincing.
No, I think David enjoys the sort of stories I tell, and I certainly enjoy the way he tells them. I enjoy writing for David, and I enjoy inking David. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be win-win for me, and I hope it's at least win for David, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's one of the things I was noticing as I was looking through the website. There's one of the goal, one of the I don't know, I always call it the wrong thing, but it's one of the
rewards.
Yeah, rewards that you're offering, instant immortality, and looks like even as we're speaking, it's already gone.
It's gone.
Talk about that.
That's a chance to get your name attached to a business or possibly just on a billboard, say, in the background. So, you know, and if it's a business, if it becomes like, you know, Russell's Coffee Shop, we might see that in the future. That, you know, Impossible Jones might go back to Russell's Coffee Shop or Russell's Bar and Grill or whatever. And people seem very taken by this idea. I know one guy for Section Zero really wants it to be a garage, a car garage, because his father ran a car garage back in the 50s. And anyways, so it's always very popular to just seed people's names in the background. And, you know, quite honestly, this, believe it or not, this goes back to the Superman days, because the Superman crowd did this constantly. Before I even worked on, well, before I was writing Superman, Jerry Ordway started doing Kiesel coffee shops in the background. And whenever characters were drinking coffee, it would be Kiesel coffee. And I know then when I was writing Superman, I established a big department store in Metropolis called Jurgens Department Store. Mm-hmm. And this was always just a fun little in-joke, you know, and now we've carried it over here into, you know, into Kickstarter land, where, you know, the supporters and backers can get their names as that department store or coffee shop or bar or whatever, you know, car garage, whatever it is.
You know what? I think I've been pronouncing your name wrong. You said it's Kiesel? Is that how you pronounce it?
You know, I'll tell you, Wayne. I don't get upset. I don't get worried. And so I'm not offended, because some generations ago in my family, there was a schism. And I have like second and third cousins that say Kessel. And there was some religious schism. And I think my side of the family, out of spite, started saying their name differently.
Oh, okay.
So I never lose sleep over it, believe me.
Well, I always tell the story. J.T. Krule was – I was interviewing him, and I asked him to do a little promo for me, and he pronounced his name Krule. And of course, everybody else – I saw him being introduced by Dan DiDio out in San Diego as Krull, J.T. Krull. And so for years and years, I called him Krull. And when he said that, I went, oh, my gosh. I said, I've been pronouncing your name wrong for years. I said, I can't believe – yeah, he says Dan DiDio did that to me.
That's pretty funny.
So I got a kick out. So now I'm on a. I try really hard to listen to how people pronounce their names, because I think that's really important. So Kiesel, right?
Kiesel, yeah. You know, like I don't lose sleep if someone says Kessel. It happens very often.
Well, see, we don't have pronunciation guides in these comics. We should have a way to pronounce them, or put something the way that it should be pronounced, so we can get it right. But you have one other thing that I'm really interested in. Someday I'm going to have enough money to be able to do this, is the alternate reality and the ultimate alternate reality. Where you take someone's face and put them in the comic.
Right.
One of them is a cop, and one of them is it looks like a henchman and stuff like that. If they get that, do they send you like a photo for you to draw in?
Yeah, we get photos. We request the photos of the people who've pledged at those levels. And then, you know, now – The picture of the cop is simply, you know, the picture I had on hand that I could use. For the alternate reality, we promise we will put you somewhere in the story. You could be an innocent bystander fearful for your life. You know, you could be a doctor, or a policeman. You could be any of those things. We don't make any guarantee that, like, you will be a policeman. The next level, the ultimate alternate reality, this is my favorite, quite honestly. You can be a henchman. And we got three slots, because there will be three henchmen for a criminal mastermind who is scheming something nefarious, and you could be part of it. And I will be quite honest, I'm really surprised those are still available, because if I had the money and I was backing this, I would be a henchman in a heartbeat.
That's funny, because I always see those things, and, you know, I always worry that I'm going to break someone's camera if they try to take a picture of me and stuff like that. But to see somebody who can actually draw somebody, turn somebody's face into something that'll be, you know, good to see on a comic page, that would be great fun.
Yeah, no, we have a lot of fun with it. We did the same thing with Section Zero, because we've done two different Section Zero Kickstarters, and the ultimate alternate reality in those is you get to be a member of Section Zero. Yeah. Unfortunately, these are, you know, I have the story figured out ahead of time, and these are basically red shirt positions. These are people that are going to die. They're not going to be around for issue after issue after issue. But no one seems to mind that. In fact, people look forward to seeing how they're going to be killed off.
Now, do you give people the artwork? I mean, if David's yes. artwork. Oh, you do get that. So you get.
Yeah,
that.
if you're at the ultimate or just alternate reality or alternate reality, you do get a page of artwork. Yes, with your appearance on it.
Yeah, that'd be fun. That would be fun to have. Just once in your life to be in a comic rather than just reading it would be great fun. I think. That's
yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
So that's cool. So how many do you get? I mean, is there one of each, or how many times can people take that reward?
Well, I mean, this, you know, in each Kickstarter, you can only do it once. And I would have to say, when we did the Section Zero, be a member of Section Zero, I did say to Pepe, the man who got it the first time around, you really can't do it again, Pepe. You know, it just doesn't work for the story mostly, you know. But I would have to. I would probably say the same about the henchman is if you're a henchman this time around, probably next time you shouldn't be a henchman. I actually could maybe see a little more flexibility there. I don't necessarily plan to kill the henchman. So maybe they could come back. I don't know. But I do like the idea of maybe kind of spreading the wealth there and letting everyone have a chance to play.
Mm-hmm. That's fun stuff. See this, the feel of this book is fun. That's one of those great words that I think applies to him. Impossible Jones and to the other stuff you do. There's in Section Zero, even it's a little more serious, and I think this will probably be, you know, it's such a great way to tell a story in a way that's entertaining as well as adventurous.
Right, you know, right.
It's fun to do.
All of my favorite, you know, it is strange that comics seems to have this allergic reaction to humor and to have fun, because I mean, you look at Indiana Jones. That's a fairly successful series of movies, and there's always humor in those. You know, Star Wars. I mean, even my favorite Star Wars, you know, The Empire Strikes Back, which, you know, has some pretty heavy dramatic moments. It also has I Love You, I Know, you know, that sort of thing where you laugh out loud, you know. Mm-hmm. I really, you know, don't understand the resistance to it in comics. And then you look at the Marvel movies, which are chock full of humor. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the ones that people complain about are the ones that don't have the humor, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, your books are going to change that, I think. They're
yeah, I'm going to change the landscape of comics.
Well, or at least start that movement going.
I mean, you know, there's a number of us out there, let's face it. I mean, I certainly feel it more than anything else. I follow in the footsteps of Mark Waid, because Mark knows how to tell a great adventure story and include humor, not at the expense of the adventure. Mm-hmm. So
it's good stuff. Now, I was reading in here too. We want to get an update as to how things are doing. You're saying that the book is the whole book is not completed yet.
No,
the first chapter is done as of the when the thing started.
Yeah, the first chapter is completed. It's written, penciled, inked, colored, lettered. It has not been composited together because I haven't had the time yet. But I mean, it is completed. And the second issue, or the second chapter now, the second chapter has been written and penciled, and inks are being done, and it still needs to be colored and lettered. And after that, you know, basically the next three chapters, that's what we're trying to raise money to cover, you know, so we can finish it and pay our bills at the same time. And that's going to take us, you know, 4, maybe even 5 months ahead of us to finish all that off. So that's what we're trying to do.
Now, do you have, like, the story planned out as far
yes.
as your – okay, so you just have to write the script for those chapters.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's going to take a little while, but I know the beats. I know the general direction. I know where we end up. Along the way, things might take a little left turn or right turn that you don't expect, but you want to leave that open. You want to leave – you want to be as surprised, you know, as the creator as you hope the readers are. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you're not entertained by it, I'm not sure that we will be.
So. Never. Yeah, if I am not entertained, I cannot believe you will be entertained. You know, and yeah, and sometimes, you know, I do feel guilty because I'll think of some little thing or there'll be some little bit, and usually it's the most minor bit in the book, and I'll like just all day long go chuckle over, I did this, and that was pretty good. Yeah. But and hopefully that's how the fans feel too when they read that bit, that it makes them chuckle and it sticks with them and stuff like that.
Well, that's something that's memorable. It'll always make the book something special to have.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I got to see you at Heroes Con. I know you're busy with this good stuff, and of course, when you got a Kickstarter going, you got to kind of focus on that. There are other conventions that you're going to be going to sometime soon that we need to let people know about.
Well, In a few weeks, I'll be in Spain. If anyone's going to be in Spain, at the I'm going to get the name of this wrong, but it's Metropoli Gion. It's in Spain, and it's a big convention. And Tom Grumman and I will both be guests, and they will be debuting Spanish edition of Section Zero there. So I'm very excited about that. Very, very excited about that.
Well, I noticed that you and Tom were next to each other as far as tables go.
Yeah, that was total coincidence. No, really? It wasn't. No, it wasn't. The plan that we asked for it, they were kind enough to do that.
Yeah, because I got a Hawkman drawing from
Tom, oh, yeah?
Which was really beautiful. I really liked it and stuff. And I asked you about it, but you said that that's not one of those things you like to do at conventions very
often. I'm just not good at drawing. And Tom luckily, you know, had his wonderful wife Nancy with him, and that way Tom can keep his head hunkered down, and Nancy's the one that can say, "Tom, you got some comics to sign." And when I'm lucky enough to be able to bring my wife to shows, Myrna, she does the same thing. She keeps me, you know, basically aware of my surroundings, because I can get very focused, and I don't work very quickly anyways. And the idea of sitting there with my head buried against my paper as I do a sketch for someone, while I would have fun doing that, I really am there. You know, that's what I do every day, right? I just sit in my room and draw or write or whatever. And I'm really at a show to meet people and to answer their questions and to sign their comics. And, you know, for me right now, that's really the prime reason to go to shows.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Very good. Well, of course, now you bring up the thing. Are there other projects you're working on? I'm sure Impossible Jones is going to keep you busy for a while. Are there other things that you've got in the, coming down the pike that we should be aware of?
Just right now, I'm focusing on Impossible Jones and Section Zero, those two books. I mean, Tom and I are working away on Section Zero 1959, which was the second book we kickstarted. And I just happen to work a little quicker than Tom, even though I just said I work slowly. I do work a little quicker than Tom. And that means I had a little downtime, and that's why I'm doing Impossible Jones. I really think alternating between the two will more or less fill up my time for the rest of the year. And I will say I'm putting together slowly on the side a little Christmas project. I'm putting together a Christmas project. And if the stars align, it'll actually be out by Christmas this year. We'll see.
Oh, cool.
But there's that. And I would only say, yeah, you know, right now I am focusing on the creator-owned stuff that we are, you know, trying to get going through Kickstarter. And a lot of that is, you know, I've played in the Marvel and DC sandbox for many, many years and had a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's about time for me to play my own sandbox and, you know, see what sort of fun I can have there. And probably the next toy in my sandbox, and I'll just dangle this here, is a character called Saint Mayhem. And he's next in line. I've already talked to an artist about drawing it. It just comes down to me having enough time to work on it.
So this is the Kieselverse? Is that what this is? All these different...
You know, I'm trying to figure out if actually these are all in the same universe. I'm not sure. I will tell you something, mm-hmm. that the Impossible Jones, this can actually give you an idea of how long I've had this idea. Mm-hmm. When I first came up with Impossible Jones... do you remember how Mark Waid had a website called Thrillbent?
Yes.
Impossible Jones was originally just going to be called Impossible, and it was going to be on Thrillbent. That was Mark and I talked about it. And as you remember, Mark and Peter Krause were doing Insufferable on Thrillbent, which was kind of their Batman and Robin character, where Batman and Robin didn't get along. And since they had Insufferable, I was going to have Impossible. And I had Mark's blessing to set Impossible Jones in the Insufferable universe. He loved the idea of a shared superhero universe. And while we may not see any crossovers, that's still going to be the case. Mm-hmm. We're going to have some reference to you know, Galahad and stuff in Impossible Jones.
Hmm. But see, now you've raised a possibility that I've got to ask about. Any chance there'll be a crossover between Section Zero and Impossible Jones?
Maybe. I never say never, but right now I see them as very different. You know, that was like, you know, is Tomb of Dracula ever going to cross over with Spider-Man? Well, it did, didn't it? But it seems kind of unlikely, you know? Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you're the kind of guy that can do those kinds of mergings, you know, make something that's somewhat more serious with something a little more fanciful and bring them together and make them work. So, you know.
Well, you have a lot of faith in me. Thank you, Russell. I don't know. You know, I you know, you say that and I do think back to the, you know, the fun we had with the Amalgam comics back in the 90s when they I mean, sometimes that sort of, you know, juxtaposition and that sort of unexpected juxtaposition is can result in really interesting results.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's all great fun. I mean, all these things are going to be real great fun to read. Let's talk a little bit more about the Kickstarter, because it concludes on Tuesday, July the 2nd at 10 p.m. Eastern Time.
Right.
And we want to make sure we get there before that so that other good things can happen. And, you know, all kinds of – you talked about all the good things that could come about, like spot varnish or those kinds of things.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that. That would be great fun.
I would love to see all of that. I would love to see all of that. I mean, I think to hit all of those goals, we might have to get up to 52,000. That might be a stretch, so to speak. But I certainly am going to do everything in my power between now and then to, you know, hit the 45 and then go as far beyond it as we possibly can. Mm-hmm.
And we need to see Impossible Jones 2. So we need to make sure this one is a success so that we can get that book.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, David and I, we'll keep doing this as long as you guys keep pledging and backing and supporting us.
Which is, see, this is where I think Kickstarter really excels. It allows people like you guys to make a story that, you know, you like, as you say, you might not get DC or Marvel to bite on this, but the fact that you get to do it and there is support out there for it, I think that just makes Kickstarter such a wonderful thing. And boy, I wish we had Kickstarter sooner.
Yeah, although, you know, I'm glad it's here now, because I mean, there's some very exciting things going on at Kickstarter. I mean, I've gotten really involved with the Kickstarter comics community and really like the Kickstarter comics community. There's some really great people, and they've got great projects, and these projects all come from their heart. And Ron Randall's Trekker project, which is on Kickstarter right now. There's another project, which is an apocalyptic Western called The Few and Cursed, which I just think is amazing. Another book that I've just been blown away by, and it's not currently on Kickstarter, but it's called Skies of Fire, and it's this Zeppelin book, and it's so great.
Yeah,
where else are you going to find a steampunk Zeppelin book?
Yeah, I supported that one myself because I really like the look of it. It's just
so great. I got their collection of, I guess, the first four issues. It's such a great book, you know, physically, but it's such a great story too. Mm-hmm. And the community on Kickstarter is very supportive and really is pulling for each other. And, you know, it's not like it's a cutthroat business in comics, but in comics, you know, you find out someone got Wolverine and you go, wow, I really wish I'd gotten the call. I really, really wanted to do Wolverine. And while, you know, maybe I like Skies of Fire, I don't have any burning desire to work on it. In fact, I want to see those guys keep working on it. Mm-hmm. I want them to succeed, and they want me to succeed, and they will help me succeed, and I will help them succeed. There's just a really great camaraderie that, not that it's totally gone in comics, but it seems really central to the Kickstarter community.
Well, you know, the more success you have, the more it gets other people to get involved and to do things like Skies of Fire and other things like that. If you can make this happen, that encourages other people to get involved. And we might get really great stories out of all this good stuff.
I know. We all want great stories, don't we? And I also enjoy, you know, beyond getting to know these creators, I also want to say Charlie Stickney, who does White Ash. That's another amazing comic that's on Kickstarter, which everyone should check out. White Ash. They don't have one going right now, but the next time a White Ash book is offered, you know, pay attention, because that is a great book. Anyways, but I also enjoy the other side of the Kickstarter equation is that direct connection with the people paying you money, paying your bills, mm-hmm. keeping you going. And I really love the fact that I can't say I know everyone's name, but there is a real, you know, they can message me directly. I will message them back directly. I get some great ideas from these people. Like I said, we're all in this together, and that is a really great feeling.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Impossible Jones is that kind of a wonderful comic that I just think can go on for years and years, and I'm just looking forward to you guys doing that because it just looks like a spectacular book. The premise is fun and adventurous, and you're getting pretty far along to get that. So we got to make sure by Tuesday, July 2 at 10 o'clock, we have more than enough to make sure that this is a reality, and Carl and David can keep these things going because it just looks like tremendous stuff. So, Carl, you guys keep it up. And, boy, I'm so looking forward to other stuff from you, as always, because I see your name, I buy the book.
You're very sweet. Thank you so much.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's great to welcome to the podcast Brent Larson, the writer for a really great and successful, already successful at the time we're even talking about it, book called Kalis. How are you doing today, Brent?
I'm doing great. Yeah, very excited.
I just signed up myself just before we got the chance to start to talk. And you had a goal that you've already met within, 12 hours?
Yeah, that's right. I did not see that coming at all. Really? Yeah, when I saw the number, I just started laughing uncontrollably for several minutes.
Well, count your blessings, because in future ones, you may not be so lucky, but, you know, it's great that you're starting off with a bang like this. That's good stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yes, definitely. It's awesome.
So it's called Kalis. Why don't you talk with people? This is the first of five, according to the Kickstarter page. Why don't you talk to us and tell us a little bit about what the story's about?
Sure. Okay. Well, the story is basically about an astronaut who goes up in a very secret CIA-backed space mission in the 60s, which is funny. I just, with my family, I saw Hidden Figures last night, and I'm watching it and thinking to myself, oh, wow, this, I'm going to have to make sure that I get all the science facts as close to reality as I can. But basically, it predates the Apollo missions to the moon. But he goes up for the CIA, and then he disappears. And the CIA tries to bury it. Eventually, it comes to light, and there's a lot of blame and disgrace. And the people are saying, how could the CIA have the money to back a whole space program on the side? And they just try to bury it. Mm-hmm. And then, present day, he returns. The lander that he went up in returns. I have this beautiful last page from the first issue of his ship crashing into the atmosphere and starting to break up. And he falls through the atmosphere. He's on fire, but he doesn't burn. He crash lands in Arizona. And he basically just starts on his quest, which will unfold very gradually. But the key thing is he really just wants to go back where he came from.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, it's decades later, so it's not going to be exactly the way it was when he left.
No. His first challenge is to try to find some clothes where he also gets his first – he goes to and stumbles into a convenience store in the middle of a robbery and – not only has to convince someone to give him a ride, but also has to deal with things like, what is this giant widescreen television? Why do we need TVs that big? Why does the coffee bar suddenly have 50 different flavors of coffee? You know, all that kind of stuff. So,
'cause I remember reading stories about people, like they were like POWs over in like in a different country. And then when they came back to America several years later, it was a very different place. Is he going to have that kind of culture shock as well?
Yes. In fact, he'll be dealing with that a lot. I've really been having a lot of fun. Basically, as he discovers this new world and kind of tries to find his place while at the same time he's trying to find out how to basically re-engage his mission. He is not only having to deal with culture shock, but it's kind of fun. I mean, I'm kind of vicariously through him experiencing kind of the shock that a lot of us feel as we just see this modern world with social media and just, you know, like, for example, when I stop and think about it, it blows my mind that we don't have to turn around to back the car out of the driveway anymore. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of hilarious to me. And I'm thinking, who was it that thought it was such a huge effort to turn your head that they had to install a camera in front of you? Mm-hmm. If you take a step back, there's so much in present society that's really just kind of weird. Not only did we not see it coming, but we didn't even think that we needed it. And then when it's happening, we're just trying to play catch up. So, but he's around several people who, you know, are informing his world and are completely caught up to the modern world. So in a future issue, we'll have him having a fight with someone while trying to talk into a cell phone at the same time. And people are going, he's in the modern world now. Look at that. He can't get off his phone. So,
well, somebody was telling me, you know, when it comes to like Uber, you know, if somebody a couple of years ago would have told us that we'd be getting to a stranger's car to go someplace, you know, we would have laughed.
Yeah, exactly. But what's weird is it makes total sense to us now because, you know, like Airbnb, you come and stay in my house. But if you're thinking about it, you're like, but I've got so much room and I could make some money on the side just having somebody come and stay. I mean, it makes total sense on the back end. On the front end, you're like, no, that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing he's going to have to deal with because, you know, he grew up and a lot of the story is going to involve flashbacks. And I've really enjoyed the use of flashbacks in this series, I guess, just to see where he's come from in the 40s and the 50s and just the kind of world that he inhabited and having to do so much research and stuff. I've spent so much time just trying to find little answers to like what was life like in the 40s and stuff like that. But then to see him arrive, you know, skip. How many would that be? 50 years, 67 years, anyway. And here he is today. And it's not like, you know, your grandparents who saw this happening and couldn't believe it. It was like he disappeared, then he came back. Everything is so different. It's like he's on an alien world, but it's a lot of fun.
It's really interesting.
I hope so.
Well, I think it will be a really good story to read because I happen to love science fiction. But the thing that I have to ask, of course, I'm a Star Trek guy.
Okay.
Why is it called Kalos?
Yes, I've gotten in trouble about that. And I was like, yes, okay, everyone, no connection to Kalos, the unforgettable. I don't want anyone sitting there. Lawyers, phasers to desist. So, yeah, Kalos, that's kind of a surprise that's going to come as the story progresses. I believe by the end of issue 5, I will answer the question. But let's say that it has its connections from Earth's history hundreds of years in the past.
Okay.
Okay. So
you'll explain all that good stuff to us as we go.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, as I read this, I see that this is a 5-issue miniseries.
Well, actually, it's a 5-issue arc.
Arc. Okay.
And I plan to end the 5th issue. I've already got it all written and ready to go, but and I make changes to it as I see the need. But there is, I think the main character's name is Scott Anders, Colonel Scott Anders, and I see it just in him the potential to go a lot longer if there's interest out there and if I see people really wanting more from this guy and the people that he meets and the people he kind of gathers alongside him on the way, then I could go probably a lot farther than 5 issues.
Cool.
So we'll see. I kind of have multiple endings in mind, judging by the interest of how people are sold on the premise and ready to go with me. I could go probably, I don't know, 30 or 40 issues. Or if not, I could just end it at 5. I guess we'll just see how it goes.
Okay. Well, Silver Line, of course, I think is Roland Mann's company or his imprint.
Right.
And stuff like that. How did you hook up with Roland? Did you go to class with him or something? Because my understanding, this is your first comic, right?
It is, yeah. Well, that's kind of a funny story. I met a guy at church who knew the two of us and knew that I knew what Roland did and knew that I did writing. I've got more of a film writing background. I do a lot of writing for short film. And I had I've been reading comics all my life. Literally, I cannot remember not reading comics. But it wasn't until recently that I started thinking, you know, I love writing for film. It's a very collaborative art, and I get to make films with my friends, and that's great. But I would love to try telling a story that there's no way, at least as far as I could see, that I could ever actually film it. You know, something which has a huge budget, something that has complex characters who occasionally behave in ways that we wouldn't approve of. But also, we could have a really good opportunity to maybe kind of explore some sides of human nature and questions about existence that you can't even really get in the movies sometimes. I love comics because of not only its ability to just have incredibly vivid set pieces, story ideas, but you're able to stick with it for a long time. And you can, if you're invested in a good story, you want it to go on a long time. You want to see not only what happens to the characters, but what happens that kind of reveals kind of more of what life is about, the kind of questions that, you know, drive us to seek meaning. Questions even, you know, even some of the smaller things, you know, what motivates us to do what we do? Why do we want to try to, you know, be good people? Why do we do bad things? Why, you know, how do we wrestle with that kind of thing? I think comics are really, after you get over the capes and the costumes, and even times a lot with that, you can really start to drill down on those kind of questions. I think comics are fantastic for that kind of communication.
Of course, you realize, too, a comic can also be a plan for how to make a movie or a TV show.
Right.
Because you're directing. Every time the artist puts a panel on the page, he's got to have perspective, he's got to have point of view, he's got to have all these things going on. And, you know, if you're a movie, you know, Frank Miller did that, not necessarily successfully, but he did it with, like, The Spirit, for example, which was based very much on his comics.
Right.
But I've seen some other ones, and I if you get these and these print out real nicely, and you end up going to San Diego or something like that, you just might bump into somebody who might think about turning this into some kind of a visual medium, which you have experience in. So
yeah, I will say, having seen or worked in both sides of it, I love that both have their own language and they're not necessarily congruous, which is why I think, like, when you think about movies like The Spirit or even Sin City or comics that, or movies that were like hewing so close to the comics, mm-hmm. that they almost lost something. It almost seemed to lose some of that spark. Mm-hmm. And I feel that's kind of what the fun of comics is, as well as the fun of writing. They're both very visual mediums, obviously, but they have both have a language that that you have to know. And when you know it, it works great. And if you try to slough off on it, it goes less great. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, every medium, or I don't know if you might want to say medium or media, has its own way of being successful. Mm-hmm. You know, something that's printed on the page, you have to deal with the page's format, as opposed to like a movie or a TV show where things are moving visually in front of us without us having to turn the page, mm-hmm. for example. So there's different kinds of things. And of course, I'm telling you something you already know well, but it's kind of fun to see this. I'm just really interested in, to see how, because I'm a big sci-fi guy. I love, and I always differentiate that from science fiction and sci-fi, because some people make a real clear difference between them.
Oh, yeah?
Are you?
What would you say is the difference?
Oh, well, science fiction is a little more intellectual. Sci-fi is kind of like more Star Wars-y. Like people always put the difference between Star Trek and Star Wars, shall we say. That's one, mm-hmm. some people do. But, you know, okay. I love something that makes me think, that takes me someplace I haven't been before. Mm. And this sounds like that the story is going to be that way. It's going to be something, a journey I'm going to want to take, because I haven't gone to this place before. And I love those kinds of things.
Yeah, well, I hope so. That's really what I want to do. And like you said, it's my first, and I'm still learning as I go. Roland has been fantastic in that regard. He's really just kind of talked me through how to tell a good story. But yeah, that's exactly why I wanted to do it. I mean, you've read comics where you basically are watching, like, I remember reading a series where the guy was like, it's like The Matrix in comic form. And I'm like, but I've seen The Matrix. And The Matrix was very deep. It was, I thought, incredible science fiction. I would say it was science fiction. Mm-hmm. But in this series, the writer was almost like, no, it's because there's so many bullets and so much, you know, choreographed violence. And that's cool to look at sometimes, but I really want to get down to, why are we interested in continuing with this? What, you know, is this person feeling as he's doing this? Is he regretful? Is he a psychopath? You know? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I hope that through my writing, we can see some of that unfold. That's my hope.
Should be fun. One of the things in your description on the Kickstarter website I got a kick out of, it says, his comic writing education is grounded firmly in his frequent purchasing of them since he was a kid.
Yeah.
I always tell people this, and as much as I have done that, I have not made the leap from reader to writer. I mean, I can evaluate ones. And I always have to admire somebody like you who can actually sit down and put a story down that is surprising and interesting with interesting characters and stuff. I can't do that. I can sit there and everything I do would probably be pablum because I don't know how to do that. When did you know that you wanted to be a writer as far as comics go?
Huh. That is a great question. You know what's funny is, I don't know if you or your listeners remember this, that John Byrne did a run on the West Coast Avengers in the late 80s. And I really enjoyed John Byrne. And I was reading in, like, Marvel Comics had a newsletter and comic book form called Marvel Age. And they did a preview of what Marvel was going to do in the coming year. And the big news was, John Byrne is taking over the West Coast Avengers. And I'm like, okay, that's great. And they had an interview with him, and the quotes from the interview is him saying, I'm going to mess with the Vision like crazy. And I remember exactly where I was when I read that, because the Vision was my guy. The Vision in the 80s, when I really started to read comics, I loved everything about him. He had such a great look. He had the smoking hot mutant wife, and yet he was also a loner. And you were like, I saw him in myself, or how I hoped to see. You know, I didn't know how to get along with people. I was closed off. I didn't know anything about women. And so I loved the Vision. And then when I heard John Byrne say he was going to mess with the Vision, I had a sense of fear that he was going to mess up one of my favorite characters, but also a sense of just anticipation that if he did it right, this could be amazing. And then I had a third sensation. That was, I wonder if I could do something like that. And what's weird is then John Byrne totally jacked up the Vision, and I was unhappy for decades. But that's the way it goes.
Well, he was so barefoot, for heaven's sake. He was a barefoot android. I couldn't figure how he would ever do that.
And then he told his wife, I don't need to hang out with you anymore. Goodbye. Yeah. She had a nervous breakdown, and he didn't care. And I'm just like, I don't even know this guy anymore. So that was – I don't know if I ever got over that.
Now, see, hold on, though. This is a thing that you might, as a writer, want to tackle at some point for Marvel. You might want to take, say, this Division, because Division – trying to think what he's actually doing now. I can't remember he's doing anything right now.
Well, actually, Tom King, who writes Batman, did a Vision series that could be some of the best Marvel stuff of the past 10 years.
Really?
So, I would highly recommend it. I know it's been collected in an Omni now. It's just called The Vision. He basically builds a family, and everything goes pear-shaped, basically, very early. But it's a great story and a great – So, yeah. I'd love a crack at the Vision.
I was thinking, I think you probably over the years have thought about stuff that you would like to have the Vision go through, shall we say, that maybe Mr. Byrne may not have ever thought of. So, you know, this is the thing. I think writers like you are the people that can take us places where we haven't been, you know, throw a little Star Trek in there. And I just think that it's a great thing when, you know, I'm always fascinated when people like you take up the mantle and start to write this stuff and come up with stuff that the rest of us don't come up with. I mean, I can't figure out what you're going to do with this character. This is why I like to read. I'm just dying to know. But I do have to ask you, I mean, as far as the character goes, the main person in Kalis, is this someone based on someone you know? Is this a product of your imagination? Where does this person come from?
You know, the thing is, Kalis in my mind has been around for at least 10 years. And it always kind of started as kind of basically a Fantastic Four ripoff. And I better explain that. Basically, the idea was, what would happen if someone who is an astronaut, you know, okay, so, well, let's take the Superman story. Superman's an alien, and he comes to Earth, and because of the yellow sun, something that he has no control over, suddenly he's literally better than everybody else, right? So what would happen if someone from Earth went to another planet, and they somehow got changed, not because of anything they did, but in a way to, you know, that they're in an alien society, and that they are somehow stronger, better? What would happen? And the more I thought about it, the more I had to wrestle with the fact that human beings are very flawed people. Mm-hmm. The idea that someone would suddenly get powers who had never had them before and would instantly want to strap on a cape and go fight bank robbers, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. But they could have a very altruistic worldview. But how long would that endure under hardship and the need for sacrifice? Mm-hmm. And especially when they are then taken back home. And this is what's happened to our main character. He essentially got to be Superman for someone else. That's kind of a very broad way of putting it. And I'm going to unfold that story a little bit over time.
Good.
But the question isn't just, you know, what kind of a person is he now? But the question is, who is he now that he's not where he was? Mm-hmm. Is he still the same guy? Is he still driven by the same things? And it'll start to come out that he has almost I actually pitched it to a friend this way. What would happen, you know, we've seen infinite variations on the Superman story, some of them good, some of them not so. But here's one. What would happen if Superman crash landed on Earth and told everybody, I don't care about you, I'm just trying to go back home? What would Superman do if then, you know, a meteor was flying to Earth? Would he try to save Earth? Or is he saying, Earth's not my priority? What would he do? I'm genuinely curious about that. And so that's kind of where the main character starts to take shape in my mind, basically. Cool. So.
Well, what we should do is make sure that we're spelling it right. So people, if they go onto Kickstarter, can find it. It's K-A-Y-L-E-S-S. And we want to make sure you can find it there. And within 12 hours, you've already gotten your goal.
Yeah.
And I imagine you've got good stretch goals coming. So what we should do is jump on board as quickly as we can to help this really go on and make this a big success so that we can find out what your vision might be of the Vision, shall we say, and do other things in the future. Because it sounds like you've got some great ideas just waiting to come out. And this is the way we can make them happen through Kickstarter. So, man, I wish you a lot of success with it. You're already off to a great start.
Thanks, Wayne.
It's fantastic. And, you know, I can't wait to see what else you got in mind. We're going to have to find out what you've got in there, because so you've already touched on Superman and the Vision, and, you know, these are the characters. I don't think about these characters. I think of Batman and Green Lantern and what I consider average people with unusual things. You look at a different perspective, and of course that always fascinates me. I want to know how other people look at these characters. So I think you're doing a wonderful job, Brent, and I cannot wait to see this comes. Now, this is the first, and from what I understand, you've already got it all completed, right?
The first, yeah, it's not printed yet. It's everything but printed. We have two variant copy or covers, and yeah, it just looks amazing. I love it.
Are you going to Kickstarter the other four issues, or is it going to depend?
I'm letting Roland run that, and he has a lot of knowledge, not only about publishing, but about Kickstarter. And so basically, he's running the show, and I'm very happy to let him. I feel like I have a pretty good grasp on telling a story. To be honest, I don't really know how to do anything else. So,
well, you know, that's what storytellers are supposed to do, you know? This is where people have trouble is not only doing telling stories, but also doing social media and Kickstarters and all these other things. It's nice if somebody could come along and kind of right off the beginning give you a good direction on how to go and do those things. And I'm sure Roland's doing a wonderful job.
Oh, yeah. Yes. It's been really an awesome ride so far.
So it's Kayless, issue number one. K-A-Y-L-E-S-S. I want to make sure of that, because if you don't know exactly how to spell it, you may not find it so easily. And we want to make it as easy as possible for you guys to jump on board and support the Brent and his team making this great story happen. See, this screams sci-fi movie to me. It just does. And I mean by that S-Y-F-Y movie. So Brent, keep it up. All I can do is make sure that we support it, and I'm dying to know how this moves forward, so I'll have to keep in touch with you. And if we do another Kickstarter or we get around to issue two, we'll have to talk again.
Yo, that would be great. I look forward to it.
That's it for this episode. Be back next time. I'll have another great interview with an excellent comics creator, something I'm sure you won't want to miss. But until then, keep reading your comics.